stay in the house, you will be having only statements, and it will be for only 35 minutes. Maybe we will talk tomorrow. We can think of that. Say, can we apply for an extra time, because on that day we have quite a lot. We have the Human Rights Commission business. I'm going to open for questions of clarity, for input. The floor is yours. And I must say, we are going to have lunch at 12 rather, not after, not 1 o'clock, because we've got enough time. But the lunch is at 12. Mrs. Dreyer, Mr. Mzondeki, Mam Kise, in that order.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to India. Should I get that right? Thank you. The one figure that really jumped out and almost put one between the eyes is on page 3 of the presentation, the table on race and gender demographics for the third sector. And there was one specifically, mining and quarry. And the figure I'm referring to is the percentage of women is 3.8. I want to ask, why do you think it is like that? Should it change? We should believe it should change. How do you think one can change it? And why should we try and change it? So there's really four questions on that.
Thank you.
No, thank you, Chair. Let's also welcome the presentation by both the presenters. Very informative. The workplace violence, the code, I see it as a tool that could assist us to deal with violence in the workplace. However, it does seem to be more inclined towards your wellness, your health, a healthy workplace. And I'm not sure how we could then be able to broaden that code to deal with the actual other aspects of discrimination. But because one of the things that I do does happen is that your emotional violence is a very difficult one in the workplace, and it can be used by the employers, as another tool to frustrate. And the difficulty with that is that it's so difficult to prove it. One has been through many cases of victimization in the workplace, and they're getting this emotional violence, and it has very serious implications. People have been admitted and so on. I do not know if in your study you have looked at what are the actual underlying causes for this violence. I would have thought that where we are now, coming from where we're coming from, we should be seeing very little of that. In our days when we used to work in the mines and so on, physical violence was very common. And it was also common also because we could not be even able to have a recourse to it. If you were hit by this boss on the mines, and not that you can't report to an HR manager, he's useless, he can't take any action. So many of us left. I think I resigned about 3 times because of that kind of a violence where you can't go anywhere else. You just start with this very bully boss. And I would have thought that should have minimized by now. But it does look like it's still going on. But also just to indicate to us, is it still like the bosses bullying, or is it now the workers, because they've got rights, also fighting back in terms of your physical violence? It's important to share that with us. From VETS, the Sociology of Work Unit, I thought that you've got to go more into the facilitation of, you know, the, how did you call it, substance change. I think that's what I hear that you say that maybe tomorrow they're going to be on that, but we wanted to hear from you. I just feel that there's something that you're not quite getting onto. If you do talk about very slow transformation, but I don't know, there seems to be something that you're not quite getting into. What is it that is actually, you've talked about maybe education not being where it is, and then I've seen those statistics, you know, declining and so on. But is there anything else that makes us to have this very slow transformation that you teach that to your own flesh? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rajbali. Use your manekra.
Okay, sorry, I'm sabotaging it. Sorry, Chairperson. You know, thank you very much for the presentation. Mine is on the, firstly on the workplace violence. You know, it takes my mind back when I was in the trade union and I had 40 years experience as an organizer and a shop steward really and truly taught me what the truth was behind the scenes. Now, Chairperson, there is many things attached to this workplace violence. It could be job security. I would do anything to keep my job and keep silent. And it could be, you know, out of desperation and also fear. That should I reveal the truth, what is going to be my position, and would I be dismissed? The employer would find some sort of a reason, not actually directed to what really happened, but will find some reason to for dismissal. Furthermore, if I should go any further, going to this ECMA or some authorities that actually take these problems. How do I come back to work? Then it starts to take psychological effect on me, and I could just leave work myself, not even thinking what is going to happen to my family or myself or whatever it is. Now, what I would like to know is that how often do the departments monitor that the conditions of employment and the act that is in place is actually implemented and it is actually going right in the workplace? Are the workers privileged to know these acts? Do they know the acts? Are there any workshops held by the department to let the workers know about their do's and don'ts and rights and wrongs? And furthermore, how secure does one feel? That as far as the workplace violence. Then I go to our young lady. She is here. Yeah. Your presentation was more as work discrimination, equity and etc. I don't know whether you felt that the affirmative action is actually applied in the correct way, because in some cases you'll find that it's still in that the apartheid system, where if that is where some of your presentation showed that I'm sorry, I have to say this. That the whites are still on the top. And what is causing the non-whites to gain those kind of positions? Is it knowledge or is it experience, or have they got these things and yet they are deprived of having this position. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mkhondi.
Thank you very much, President. I just want to welcome the presentation from the two presenters. I'm interested in the employment equity complexity in action. Whether this complexity is not related to something that I'm reading. The origin of the coercive labor market in South Africa 50 years ago and the complexity today of the implementation and the rate at which the Employment Equity Act could be implemented here in South Africa. Because you see, this regime is giving us a systematic agenda of the apartheid system to coerce the race, the white race, in terms of giving skills and so forth, you know, promoting them. Which, when we implement in South Africa, the Employment Equity Act, people will say is an apartheid in reverse. So what could be the linkages? And what could be, what government can do to apply some of the strategies that were applied then, that were successful in making sure that they affirm white people to the position that they occupy today, as if they are the, you know, the owners of skills, the owners of knowledge in the South African society, that they are deployable anywhere that Africans can be. That is the first thing. The second one is what we're trying to do to relate the rate of transformation in higher education into the rate of transformation in society at large. What is a symbiotic link? A symbiotic link in a sense that is the rate that is minus now than it was positive before 1994 in the higher education transformation, not what because of coercion strategies then. For example, we had strong student organizations, we have strong academic organizations, we have strong SRCs that forced the institutions to transform. Then today we have a law that says you can do 1, 2, and 3 for you to transform and makes people not move at all. What is the link there? I'm raising this because of the unit of knowledge as one. For example, lecturers are still predominantly white. We move through these institutions. Difficult to get bursaries, difficult to get scholarship for research. Yeah? Scholarships are different to white. That is why white men dominated in terms of research. So those are the complexities. Students were failing, particularly black students, not because they don't know the work, but because of their race. So I want you to also relate to that. The last thing that I wanted to ask, you ask us as MPs, but we also need, you know, academics to assist us. How should we make this equilibrium? Because in the process of a nation building, in the process of because we can find it even in African men, for them, they're not interested to empower African women. It's an issue of the relationship between the race and gender struggles. And how are you going to make them to be equilibrium? You know, in terms of that. Because it's about the relationship between the race and gender. And what are the effects in terms of trying to make them to transform. The last thing is on definition. I think Honorable Mzondeki tried to raise this issue for me. The definition of the workplace violence. For me, it's very narrow. It's narrow because it's only focusing at employees. So it's related now. Where you find that workers, they have their own organizations that are powerful. that can also, I was just thinking when they presented, I was thinking about the school system, a school, where you find that students have organizations that are strong, and they can be violent to their own teachers. They can be violent to the system. So now, how do you relate to that? And the power of unions also to be used, you know, to change the status quo, to change the structure, to change the management, to change everything. So what is the relationship? So is that not narrow in your own sense? And what is the influence of the community violence in relation to the workplace violence? Because there should be a link in terms of how the society is structured and how that influences each other. Those are a few questions that I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Babu Chali?
Question about what our problem here, I mean, for both papers or presenters, is for my problem is caused by the fact that their papers are general. They are presenting white men or women, black men or women, Indian white women in general, as if you can find these white women or men, black women or men, Indian, Caribbean men, outside the class. They are not outside classes. There is this South African society with classes. And in these classes, there are these white men, black men, colored men, and white men. I think if we start from there, we'll be able to come to a right conclusion, because we'll not be generalizing. We'll be dealing with a class and know how to deal with that class. And not speak of a black woman as if black women are outside the classes. There are black women who come from, who are wives or daughters of multimillionaires. So when you look at that that woman, don't equate him with a woman living in that. In that squatter camp or informal settlement. So this is called, I think, by the fact that a worker or an employer or a capitalist, if you like, is appearing in the syllabus. Not in the syllabus, in the dictionary of our politics, be it in the universities or outside the universities. That disappearance. So because of that disappearance, the result is this generalization. And this generalization is causing confusion. We end up thinking that talking about gender is enough. Forgetting that you are equating Mrs. Multimillionaire and Mrs. Mrs. Turen. You just say gender. And once you say gender, you think you've said everything. And these people are different. So I think people in universities must help us in clarifying this, in separating these two things, the Mrs. Turen and the Mrs. Multimillionaire describe. Otherwise, you end up lost, just completely lost. worried about gender equity, gender equity, and the whole struggle of women's love for emancipation.
Ends up being a struggle between men and women, which is not the case. It's a class struggle that is involved here. And you must not hide this class struggle.
I'll finish now. Yeah, I said there are no white people here, no black people here, no colored people here, in general. All these people are in their classes. You must take them out of their classes, analyze them separately, and say, that white worker, your class brother, is that black or African worker who is staying in that squatter camp? And the colored worker, you belong there. You Indian worker, you belong there. You multi-million, 5 billionaire, you belong to this black millionaire cluster. So that we don't make a mistake of generalizing and end up not knowing where to begin. There is something the lady said about we must introduce an element of class inequity and labor market. I didn't understand very well what is this introducing a class equity in labor introduce element of class inequity. Element of class inequity. Because the very fact that there is this word equity, it is because there is this class society. That's why there is this word equity. Because of the fact of this class society. Which takes me back to what I was saying about no black or white or Indian people in general. So all I want to say is that you intellectuals in university, help us to come with a people that are going to help us in our way. Don't lock us more in darkness. Take us from that darkness. You can only take us from darkness if you don't generalize about these people. Thank you.
Thank you, Jesse. Mrs. Weber.
Thank you, Chairman. Studying this graph on the composition of professionally qualified people, and it stands out that qualified African men, African women, and white men drop, and professionally qualified white women rose. Is there any reason for this, and has there any sort of research been done as to whether this might be a brain drain? Thank you.
Thank you. Those were the questions. I don't know who is starting. Oh, there's another question here. Danu Mukhani.
Well, thank you, Chair. I also want to welcome
you. Chair, I was saying I also want to welcome this presentation, but I want to check from two presenters, one question that I want to raise to both of them, that whether the current laws does not address problems around workplace discrimination, the current laws that we're having. That's my first question for both presenters. My first question for Dr. Stanman is that why particularly women are at the high risk, and whether this implies globally in terms of this higher risk, or it's only in South Africa. My second question to Dr. Sunman is that he mentioned in the table there, He mentioned that there is a 27.1% racial harassment in the public sector and about 17.4% in the private sector. Now, I just want to check what type of or what form does this harassment take in public sector and in private sector? And whether what is it that can be done to deal with that particular racial harassment? My second question to Kezia. In her closing presentation, she said that we need to facilitate substantial change. This substantial change that needs to be facilitated. I just want to check what are these substantial changes that necessarily has to be taken. And the second question is that, the third question is that you said we need strong linkages to education and training. Now my question is that I want to check whether the intervention of CITAS in terms of linking this education with skills, whether it does not address some of these problems that you are having in terms of showing that we intervene correctly in terms of skills. My last question is that to what extent does affirmative action instilling fear to historically advantageous majority, minority, this animal, this big animal, affirmative action, what fear does it actually do to previously advantageous minority? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Daddy. Those were the questions. I don't know who wants to start. Is it you, Dr. Steiner? You want to kick off?
I'll kick off. I just had an instruction with you. Sometimes I'm chair. You start. I'm going to answer the first question. What are the causes of workplace violence? Now, it's interesting, Karl Marx was the first to warn that capitalism might cause workplace violence. A long time ago. But more and more people said it is the discourse of the restructured workplace. Because people cling to their jobs, they're insecure, they want to advance in the workplace, there are so many jobs, so many people, and you have a very competitive society. So workplace violence is one of the results of the very competitive workplace that we see. There are other causes, and I just want to focus you on page 9 of the, you all have it, the Code of Good Conduct to Prevent and Deal with Workplace Violence. Page 9 is factors compounding the frequency and the incidence of workplace violence. And one of it is non-compliance with OHS. It's as simple as that. Stress are too high in the workplace. There's very high demand, very low control. People snap, and stress is one of the factors that are closely linked to workplace violence. And non-compliance with OHS is sometimes the reason, the layout of the office. There are many, many reasons. There aren't just one reason. It isn't with the individual. It is with a whole cluster of reasons. Lack of policies is one of the reasons. If we have policies in place, people will comply to it. If we enforce those policies, they will definitely not try their luck and intimidate a person. Organizational factors are huge, and that is management style, dialogue and communication between all the stakeholders, general communication, information, corporate culture, values, all of those are reasons. Environmental factors like noise, like colors, illumination, temperature, ventilation, things like that, all parking areas, lack of security and so on, all causes workplace violence. And individual factors, are we appointing the right people, probably with a history of violence or violent behavior, personal recognition of risk factors, we need to know the risks of certain people, personal conduct and well-being, and the availability of after-incident management with people. And we've got to be very careful, because people who are victims of workplace violence sometimes turn into the perpetrators. And I think the service charter of the SAPS also recognizes that fact, that we must take care of people that have been victims, that they not in desperation actually become perpetrators of violence. So the interpretation of the law, some employers ignore the law, they prefer to ignore the law, while others would follow it and make it a success. And I think that is a great... And exploitation. And I'll talk about that too, the unnecessary overloading of staff. It's become a fashion. Everybody is very proud of working 16 hours a day. It's not healthy. It's not healthy for society. And it also brings workplace violence, make it a reality. And the abnormal hours people are working in normal situations. We all work overtime, but there are limits to it. Child labor is also a form of workplace violence. So these are the causes of workplace violence, the unfair treatment of people, cheap labor. But there are many reasons. There are many personal factors that contribute to workplace violence. I do not believe that all workplace violence are perpetrated by psychopaths, like the Snakes and Suits book and so on, recommends. It's opportunistic. It's because there's no policies in place. And it's as simple, actually, as that, is that if there's policies in place, people will not perpetrate it. Why do we still have workplace violence? Workplace violence, in this case, cases that I refer to, has nothing to do with color. It happens everywhere, every day, and among all people. This is a colorless phenomenon, and it is not just South Africa. We have it all over the world. The incidence of workplace violence, especially emotional abuse, is very interesting. It's 83% is top down because the power differential plays a role. But there is 17% that is bottom up within and emotional abuse. When that happens, it's probably when a person's got an enemy that's higher up, or a peer that's very competitive that would support this person to actually have it. But normally it's top down, 83%. But that 17% is usually a peer bullying. That person's also actually a satellite for top down bullying or peer to peer bullying in the workplace. Very difficult. Did I answer your questions adequately? Okay. Then the other one is that workplace bullying, people fear, they are so scared to report it, and that is true. Most people will not report it because they fear of losing their job, of being intimidated, being retaliated against, the boss taking steps against this person, and it can actually lead to dismissal. I think that if we have a code in place, we can really, really deal with that. Because where they actually started enhancing help, dealing with workplace violence on that level, where the awareness was raised, people got empowered and they started speaking out. And I think if management gives that power to the people to speak out, to say, listen, you are abusing me now, you are bullying me, this is a racial harassment, and they can report it and take it up, that power... Actually, that's enormously empowering, just a policy. And that is why a code will help, I believe, change it. In the CCMA, I must say, it is so traumatic for the victim. The biggest trauma is taking it to the CCMA. Because it's so difficult to prove. But a code is, take that that subtleness out. The code says explicitly, it can be overt, covert, direct or indirect. It is a broader definition. It actually needs to be broadened if we have to include all violence. But it broadens that definition. It explains how it happens. And it also explains that it's cumulative. In some cases, you know, just the horseplay, hitting somebody or something, that is, you say, oh no, come on, that's not bullying. But if it happens every day, it's different. If there's an insult every day, if there's sarcasm every day, it has a profound impact on the victim. And a code focuses our attention to that because people do not always understand what is emotional abuse in the workplace and why is it so serious that something needs to be done. So when we spell it out in a code, it is clear that it's the small things and the big things that actually causes workplace violence. And then there was a question, how often do departments that condition is implemented or workers privileged to know the act and how... Okay, these are the more for the Department of Labor, because what I know is that I go on a crusade or a mission on workplace violence, and I inform the public. I inform businesses. I've been to all the government departments, and they've attended some of my courses and so on. So there is a great awareness, but yes, there needs to be a greater awareness. For instance, if a code should be introduced in whatever form, there needs to be provision for training so that, like our basic conditions of employment, that we have a poster there and say, this is the guidelines towards dignity in the workplace. As in as much as you shall not scream and so on anybody, the Bartle Pennett principles, there is also principle 5, which we treat one another and we expect it to be treated from the public, because my concern is sometimes is that we focus so much on service delivery that we can ask the question, but what about the treatment of our workers? How must they be treated? Can't we expect the same from our public to treat our employees and make them more dignified in the workplace? The other one is, that is a good one. We're focusing on the employees in the workplace in our definition. And there are other power differentials at play in the workplace. This is a very valid question, and probably this relates more to structural violence. And maybe we must differentiate between interpersonal violence in the workplace, and that definition can only be applicable to interpersonal violence, and then systemic violence, where the system, whether it be a student body, an employer, a trade union, can be abusive to the employer, and that we can refer to as structural violence. But yes, it is a burning issue there, is that it is not only the employees that can be abused in the workplace, but also the employer. In many ways, vandalizing a building and so on is a series of things and a big problem. So I would suggest that we look at interpersonal violence, workplace violence being interpersonal violence as structural violence. And then we've got another question here, is whether current laws does not discriminate, why particularly are women at a higher risk in South Africa? I think this is part of the general problem we have with women being vulnerable in the workplace, especially when physical violence is at play, and that is because of the perpetrator, in most of the cases, being male, and women are then at higher risk because of their physical vulnerability. But also a very interesting phenomenon is in emotional violence, women are at higher risk, about 55% of the victims, and women are inclined to abuse women more often than men. Unfortunately, that is one of the what research indicates, and that is part of the equity problem, where women still have this perception, and I've seen it so many times, that women still have the perception that they're not good enough and probably participating there. Table says that 27.1 racial harassment in the public sector. The reason for this is this was the case in public hospitals, and it is because that violence in the streets often spills over to the institutions. A gang will, for instance, enter a hospital, and there will be a lot of violence happening there. The chances of that happening in the private sector is less. It is not because the private sector is better, it is just that their risks are better managed and much less than the public sector, who has to accommodate everybody. So, and why it happens and how it happens, this racial harassment, is that somebody would say, I don't want a black nurse, or I don't want a white doctor, and that is still the racism that prevails in our society. Again, the workplace is a place to address it, where we can make it better by setting examples, helping people to carry this over to society. I just think that anything we do in the workplace has a cascading effect on our community. And I think I answered all the questions.
Yes, that's it.
In relation to the workplace violence, now I can understand why the percentage is so high in the public sector, but I can't really reconcile why the physical violence is so high in the public sector than in the private sector. I don't know what's the conclusion of the study. It is because it has concentrated largely on the health sector versus the other sectors. Without looking at, I'm representing a constituency here, a constituency of the agricultural sector, the farming community, where you've got a high rate of physical abuse, violence, that is between the employer and the employee. And at some point, between the immediate person, maybe the intruder in our language, which is used by the management also to physically abuse the workers on the ground. So I'm trying to get a sense of why the discrepancy between the two.
There's going to be follow-ups, Susan.
Okay.
We thought we would finish early, but I think that I should just open for more questions. So we will see how it goes. The follow-up, Ms. Nichols.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I'm not sure that maybe she answered my question and I just went off that. I also asked a question specifically on the relationship. In your last answer, you tried to, but you said the workplace violence can spill over the community. But I wanted to ask, what is the influence of a societal violence or a community violence to that of the workplace violence?
Before that, too, Ngata Mokhani.
Chair, earlier on I asked a question that what form does this racial harassment take? But I could not get the sense that this has an answer that has been answered to my question. So I still want to repeat it here as a follow-up. What form does this kind of racial harassment take in terms of public sector and private sector? Thank you.
I'm sure those are the questions, Sue and Yeah, I'm sure there's still more will be coming, because one would want to know why are there differences. I mean, if I link this question with what Mr. Mohale is saying, why are there differences in the sexual harassment prevalence between the private and public sector? Could it perhaps be because more cases are being reported in the public sector and due to policy protection than in the private sector? So I don't know. I'm sure more questions will be. It is so interesting, but those questions, maybe if you are not able to answer them now, you will also respond in writing in order for us to save time. But also again, one would ask, what is the linkage between HIV and AIDS prevalence and workplace violence? Has there been a rise in the cases related to HIV and AIDS abuse in the workplace over these years? So if you can just try and round up, we are looking at time. Over to you, sir. Your mic.
Chair, the honorable doctor says it's very traumatic to take your case to CCMA. I don't know that can be a reason for that particular statement, because I remember in 1985 I had a case. There was no CCMA by that time. There was only labor court. I could not succeed in my case. I've seen quite a number of cases that have been taken to CCMA. People are succeeding. Now, I just want to understand around this thing of if you take your case to CCMA is a very traumatic kind of situation that you find yourself in. I don't understand that thing, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Over to you, sir.
What I mean by traumatic, to take it and being very traumatic, is from a victim perspective, it is traumatic to take it to the CCMA. If the victim hasn't got enough witnesses, willing witnesses, to come forward, it is very difficult to prove the case because it's one word against another word. The other thing that I found with the CCMA, and I'm actually just saying that the CCMA is very good, but they say, listen, the victim must actually bring proof that they tried to resolve the problem. They did everything they could to resolve the problem. And that in the case of constructive dismissal, that they are, that it is because the system didn't work for it. Now, 10%, that is what I've been told, 10% to 15% of cases succeed on constructive dismissal on the grounds most of the time of workplace violence, bullying, or discrimination in the workplace. It's the success rate is still very low. There are successes. I've witnessed successes. But it is still difficult. And that is what I mean. It is still traumatic, because if you lose, I think it is traumatic for anybody to go through, to lose a case in workplace bullying. But what we've seen is that labor courts now talk about vicarious liability. And there is something like vicarious liability for post-traumatic stress. Now, this is something that is probably just the last 2-3 years that there have been cases where they test that the vicarious liability of the employer to actually see that somebody is not harassed and it doesn't result in post-traumatic stress. But yes, with a 10 to 15%, that's my information. I may be wrong, but that's my information, that it's 10 to 15% on constructive dismissal, which is mainly representing workplace violence cases. So that is very difficult. The other question is, does it answer, is it okay?
Don't worry about that. Just respond to whatever.
I would like to know if you respond. So the discrepancy between the public and private sector, it's huge. But if you look at the hospitals, if you look at the staff shortages and things, at public hospitals and you compare it with private hospitals, there's almost no comparison. And that is why the figures are so much different. The reason for this abnormally high figure of physical violence is because it includes psychopathology, like Alzheimer's disease, like mentally ill people, like psychiatric patients that are sometimes very, very violent. So it is not just criminals walking in and deliberately attacking a person. It is sometimes sick people because of illness injuring healthcare workers. So that is also why it is so high. And I also think that the state takes the bulk of responsibility for people with mentally ill and so on, that our government hospitals are absolutely inundated with cases like this, and hence the high incidence of violence, apart from areas that are notoriously gang areas and so on. Those hospitals have the gang violence also. So you have two worlds, the private hospitals and also the criminal care. So you have the private hospital, that is another world actually, than our public hospitals, who have to cater for everybody. And that is where the difference comes in. And probably carry the bulk of the burden of those that are challenged in society with a lot of diseases like permanent, like mental disability, Alzheimer's, and many other of these. So that is the huge discrepancy. If we look at the other racial harassment. Okay, racial harassment, let me just explain what it is. It is slander, it's remarks, it's innuendos. It is a half-truth, it's smirking, it is everything that can actually be regarded as sarcasm, as innuendos, as a direct or an indirect remark referring to race. So this is the form that it takes. And some people, especially in the health sector, when they're not happy, would actually curse the race that are helping them if they're not happy. And they swear, and they abuse people, and they use language that are intolerant, that are racially abusive, and that hurts people very much. Now, as much as bullying hurts people, racial harassment is something that really hurts right young. People are extremely traumatized when they are abused because of the color of their skin. And again, my research in this is colorless. It is the reaction of everybody, and the racial harassment is referring to everybody. But my research also indicated that where people, whether they are gay people, whether they are a white group or a black group, whenever they are a minority, when people are a minority, they are more likely to be discriminated against. This is not a South African phenomenon, it's a worldwide phenomenon. And I just think that we should just see this in the normal context of discrimination. Because the ILO, ICN, WHO, PSI do not specifically go into race issues. It is looking at the whole phenomenon rather than the race dynamics. We are not different than the rest of the world.
If I can just round up, Sue.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, but when looking at some of the questions, we would like you to really send it to us, because we will be studying your presentations. And now let me give over to you, Madam, to respond to some of your questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. No, okay. Sorry.
Your mic. Okay. If your mics are not off, it affects the other mics.
Thank you. Okay, there were 7 people who asked questions, and I'm also aware of the time, so I'm going to give brief responses, but hopefully do your questions some justice, and then I think the same comment I should do some written submissions as well, or written comments. Okay, the first question was on the very low number of women in the mining sector. What's interesting about that sector is even though it's extremely low numbers of women, most of the change has happened post-apartheid. What we find is during apartheid, women in mining tended to do office work, in slightly low management level jobs, but mainly office work. What we see post-apartheid is that there's increasing numbers of African women going underground, and that's quite new in our labour market altogether. You asked the question about whether we would want gender equity there. I think we want more equity than we've got, certainly. I suppose if we've got a progressive outlook and a true gender equity, there's no reason why the very difficult, demanding, physically draining work that mining is, there's no reason why that should only fall on men's shoulders if we have a true gender equality view. I think given some of the examples that Ndo gave about the physical nature of the work, the immense violence, I think everyone would agree that historically and continuing today, our research bears out that it still is today. There's lots of cases where unions are taking cases and the police are investigating cases of assassination on some mines as well. So I think a lot of that violence still goes through. So again, we do need to think, I think, quite rigorously about the particular demands that that sector would have and the kind of gender integration that we would have, and do the mines cater, because again, like Sue's been mentioning, in that case, often women will also experience a lot more violence because, you know, they're an other in that kind of sector. So I think we need to think very seriously as well about, do mines have the kind of resources and backing in order to help that equity along and to just protect workers in general, be they men or women. That's a quick answer to that one. Okay, the second question is on substantive change, and two people raised this question. So I think, yes, I think it's extremely complicated, and I think it really does depend on the sector, that there isn't one universal reason why. For example, in some sectors, what we'll find is a lot has to do, particularly the more professional and management-type jobs, a lot will have to do with institutional culture, people not taking seriously, not having the decision-making responsibilities that their job should entail, facing racism and sexism in the workplace. We also find in one of our case studies, what we found is what's referred to as the upward floating color bar, which is basically a form of window dressing, where you'll have black managers who are put into a position, but a second position is created that is where the power is deferred to. So basically that shell of manager becomes defunct of any responsibility, and then a second white person is put somewhere else, and again they retain the power. So one of our industries shows that very, very clearly, that that's happening in one of the sectors. I think in some sectors it certainly has to do with commitment of managers on the one level, whether HR takes it seriously, whether it has its own portfolio of equity and transformation, or it's just assumed under general HR. Other issues also have a lot to do with unions. We would hope that unions would be the ones motivating for equity in each of these sectors,
But of course, many unions, because of other workplace restructuring, have become totally defunct in a way, and they're struggling to survive and struggling to just have pay demands met for their workers, so they can't actually, you know, demand or pressure for equity. So that's a few of the things. But there were other questions in terms of affirmative action and application. Maybe I can come back to that when I've forgotten what I was going to say. Sorry. Somebody asked as well about there were a lot of questions about professionals. One of the answers linking the university and professionals as well, of course, is that students who come and study at the university to study things like engineering, medicine, etc., will come and often get bursaries from government departments, from parastatals, from private companies, and of course they, you know, then there's no chance of them moving into the academic sector. So that's one aspect of professionals, I think. Okay, the second question on professional was to do with a white woman and why that sector has increased, that category has increased and others haven't. Again, I think a lot of it has to do with history, that if we look historically at the labour market, white women have been in the category of professionally qualified or clerks. They find it more difficult to break through into the top management. So in a way, professionals is the glass ceiling of where a lot of white women are contained. Again, I think that's something we definitely need to do more research into. I think, like we suspected earlier, that a lot of particularly African men and African women might have, over the 5 years, been catapulted up even further, but again, leaving the gap of white, other people aren't filling that. The question about, several people raised linking affirmative action to reverse discrimination. I think that's, and this also links back to the substantive change. I think in a way we have to think that people respond to affirmative action and employment equity on two bases. The one is the substantive, is their life really changing? Are their material conditions changing? Is their respect and dignity being rewarded? And the other is, in terms of reverse discrimination, I, personal opinion here, I certainly wouldn't see affirmative action or employment equity that way, but I know many people do. And at the same time, we can't just be dismissive of those views and expressions, because for the people who have those fears, as someone mentioned, they're very real, and they're real to those people, and they do contribute to the brain drain in terms of, you know, now increasingly see people, upper-class white people, sending their children to private higher education institutions, or even sending them abroad to Australia, England, you know, and long-term looking to have a future outside of South Africa. So I'd say affirmative action isn't reverse discrimination, but we can't just be dismissive of that, because it's a real concern of people, and it will have an implication on skills development, later on down the line and that. I think there was another question about the link between universities and social transformation. I think certainly, undoubtedly, the students we have at universities today are not the students that are leaving our country now. Just to give you some examples, although I'm sure you know very many. We learned recently that one of the residences that was linked to Jobo's Gen didn't have electricity for 3 months. And it was during winter, and the students had to study by candlelight. Not a single murmur. No, obviously some parents wrote letters, but there was no demonstration on campus. It's very, very difficult to get students motivated about anything. So again, that has to do with broader changes and how we get the future generations to have the social concerns and social justice views that we have. It's very important. I think a lot also has to do with bursaries. The whole financial aid system at universities is becoming more and more difficult for working class people to send their children to university. So again, we look at broader restructuring. People who used to do cleaning work at used to get medical aid, they used to get groceries to send their children to university. With restructuring, those private companies don't offer any of those. So again, it becomes an elusive dream. So again, I think, and just linking to the gentleman's comments on class, I think we have a much closer common view than was maybe suggested. I think if you were really to bring class to the center of a discussion on transformation, I think maybe we might even find that today we're more self-congratulatory than we actually should be, because I think you're very right. If you just prioritize race and gender, you know, and the class elements get lost, then what we're saying is there's this much improvement in terms of race-based equity, this much improvement in terms of gender-based equity, but what we're not seeing is, as you said, where those people's class roots come from. And again, what I was really trying to say in the presentation was just for a recentering of class in our discussion on transformation, so that, as I said, so that we don't just be of course it's important to have transformation from the middle to the top, but just so that we're not just preoccupied with that, but we look at the broader transformation across all levels and all income groups. Okay, there was a question about whether our laws as they are do address the problem. I think to a large extent they do, but more can always be done. I think at the moment, certainly around employment equity, I think I'll venture to say that we have quite a voluntaristic legislation. Obviously, if you're a large company and have an income over a certain amount or a number of employees over a certain amount, then, of course, you're obliged to report. But the burden falls on those particular companies. And, of course, if we look at the employment equity reports, they suggest that, you know, over the last 5 years there's been a decline in the amount of reports being submitted. So I think that in terms of implementation, I think perhaps more needs to be done. Again, you know, debates would be about how rigorously that should be done and whether it should be done punitively or not. But I think people, perhaps companies out there are sort of losing patience in a way, the ones who do continually report, because the burden to prove their transformation falls on fewer and fewer companies. So that's an aspect there. There was also a question about education, training, and CETAs. I think certainly CETAs do start to address some of the problem, and certainly training, you know, training's moved a lot in the last 10 years, so no one would disagree with that. But I think as well, like we were saying before, if you look at the statistics and you see that the labor market is still hierarchical in terms of both race and gender, and the training is provided to those people in those occupations, then the impact it has is limited, because it keeps, you know, for example, a manager, you find most of the people who have management type training through CETAs are white men. And so, yeah, there's questions there. I think someone also asked, I mean, another point just to raise, it might be an aside, is that I think we need to look very, very seriously at education. Education in universities, education pre-universities, because what we're finding in universities is that across the board, across all race and gender groups, what we used to refer to as academic development skills that in the past used to be offered primarily to, you know, second or third language speakers are now needed by everyone, even if they've come from the very wealthy public schools. So I think we need to very seriously look at that, because a lot of pressure is falling on universities to play catch-up with what should have been done at high school level and then to get the degree and the skills. And I think many employers out there would agree that perhaps the skills that are being produced by university are not quite where they'd like them to be. Certainly, I think linking very broadly to some of the other comments on affirmative action, I think certainly affirmative action does, I think it should remain, and it does have mostly positive outcomes, but we do have to bear in mind the negative unintended consequences that come with it. So, for example, this claim of reverse discrimination, but the impact that it has in terms of people moving out of the skills labour market, whether they be of any race, gender, or class position. And I think there was one more.
Thank you, Kelly.
Okay. All right, I'll stop there.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. When you are perhaps asked to clarify your statements or clarify your presentation, you'll be willingly to do so.
Yeah.
When dealing with this, but thank you very much. That was Kazan Lewin and Dr. Susan Seyman. Your presentation will assist us when engaging and dealing with this huge animal, which is feared by most of us. But thank you very much for coming. Members, we have gone beyond the time we suggested, but that was a very fruitful engagement. And thank you, the representatives from PMG, researchers, members of the public, the two beautiful students there. Thank you for coming to listen to members of parliament and also presenters. Thank you, the media. Thank you. And tomorrow, as I said earlier on, we will be dealing with the four presenters. We are going to see how we fix these others in. If you remember, we said we wanted Salga also to come and present, even Parliament. Parliament, they have just acknowledged our invitation, but I haven't heard anything from them, but we really wanted Parliament to also give us a picture of what is happening. Mamsis, do you want to say quickly?
Chairperson, before you close, one can sit and think here as to we listen to presentations, we get answers, and what next? Now, couldn't we find a way forward of getting together and saying, these are the things that we have to do arising from the presentation, arising from the question. What do we do from here? We know now what is happening, and we know what we can do. So wouldn't a few people, they say, a few heads together makes a lot of difference. So if come together and find a way forward after all the presentations that we are aiming at in the labor field, and see what we can do to go forward to say it's not within these four walls, but we have to take it right out of here and say we're going right there to see that things are coming right and it's not continuing. Then we don't see those differences that is still happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Mamsis. Just to remind you, when we were sitting discussing about these public hearings, we said after all these presentations, we will be sitting discussing the presentations, all these presentations, oral and written submissions. It is our duty. We are faced with a huge task on listening to, or also looking at this presentation and at the end of the day to come up with a recommendation to Parliament to say here are the views of the people, and if it's not enough, as we have agreed, we will be going out to choose provinces, especially the provinces which have responded to this call to go and finalize our work there. But thank you very much for coming from the department, Mr. Mkalipi. Thank you very much. We are really hoping that, as we have agreed, that you will be with us on all these days of public hearings. I think the lunch is ready, the finger lunch. Please help yourself as you go out. Until tomorrow.